Hello and welcome to Science Unscripted. It's Connor here.
And Gabe.
Just going to read one email. We have a lot of science coming. We're probably going to run out of time, so we're going to stick to this one email. It's from Carolyn. And it once again refers to a study that our listeners around the world can't stop writing us about.
Mm-hmm.
It's the study on what seems to be a truism that your name over the long term changes the shape of your face. We don't need to go through all the details of that study. I think we've done it 3 or 4 weeks in a row now. But effectively, people can figure out more often than chance what your name probably is if they're given a list. Because somehow your face seems to represent that name. I don't know.
What did Carol say?
Carolyn.
Carolyn.
She said, how can anyone know what a person's face could look like if the person had been given a name other than the one already given? Her interesting anecdote, the part of the email I liked second best, was my mother once told me that she'd wanted to call me Janet. Her name's Carolyn, but her mom thought about naming her Janet.
I knew a Janet.
Yeah. Then she goes to high school and a girl called her Janet.
What?
And she asked her why she used that name. She said she thought I looked like a Janet. Yeah. It's just, names are crazy. And yeah, there's some connection toward, I don't know, a name and who you should be or who you were destined to be. The last thing she says is my favorite part of the email. Thanks for doing a show that is so easygoing. You convey information in such a relaxed manner that makes the topics sound like things a group of friends can chew on over a round of beverages.
That's literally what you say to the interview partner, the people we interview. You tell them to speak as if we're in a bar, you're just talking to your friends.
Yes.
So she's right on the mark with that.
Carolyn, you somehow knew, the way we ask our researchers, scientists around the world to talk to you. That's the whole idea.
Yeah.
But in many different ways, thank you for that email.
But a science right off the top here.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure if you guys saw this, but researchers in China at the University of Tianjin and Peking University, that's in Beijing, have used stem cells to cure diabetes. So
stem cells to cure diabetes.
Right. So a year ago, this procedure happened. Stem cells were transplanted into the pancreas of someone suffering from type 1 diabetes, where the beta cells in the pancreas don't work. No insulin is secreted. Stem cells were put in that pancreas, and 2.5 months later, 10 weeks later, that person was secreting insulin and regulating her own blood sugars. This is a 25-year-old Chinese woman.
One woman?
This
was a test case on one woman,
yes,
whose immune system had killed the cells in her pancreas that make insulin.
So diabetes is complicated. Why type 1? Why it happens, your cells, there's an autoimmune reaction in your body, and your own cells attack your own cells.
Yeah.
Right? It's not supposed to happen. It does. And they happen to attack these beta cells in the pancreas that produce insulin, killing them. They don't grow back. It's a chronic illness. And now using stem cells, these researchers have apparently cured diabetes. I mean, this is something that people have been talking about for, in my 22 years ago. I can remember the moment I heard it. Oh, don't worry about it. Because I'd just been diagnosed with diabetes. You're fine. They're using stem cells. This is going to be cured around the corner.
So I guess my question for you is, with the context you've given it, this makes you, do you feel cynical? Like, oh, it's still years away? Or is this is a huge breakthrough the way you see it? This has finally happened and now...
Scientifically, it is a huge breakthrough because it's been done. Whether it's going to be, whether this can be applied to many people, that's highly doubtful. Because you're going to have to use somebody else's stem cells. You can't use your own stem cells. And in order to use somebody else's stem cells, you have to dial the immune system down so low. These people have to be immunosuppressed. This woman in China was immunosuppressed because she had a liver condition.
Mm.
That's why they used it on her.
Right.
You can't just go and immunosuppress me, dial my immune system down dangerously low where that any pathogen can kill me.
We talked
about
this.
Just to cure diabetes. You can't do that. Ethically, a doctor cannot give me that choice.
Well, we talked about this when we talked to Mark, the Dusseldorf
Mark
patient.
Yeah,
cured of HIV. And the reason he was allowed to be cured was that he had blood cancer. He had leukemia, which gave doctors the option, or they were forced to dial down his immune system anyway, so why not cure HIV? Mm. So yeah, this is... not applicable for most people.
At this point, you can get a transplant of the cells that create the insulin into your pancreas. So somebody who dies donates their pancreas. They take the islet cells, these islets of Langerhans, named after a German doctor from 1866 who discovered them. You take those islets of Langerhans, have them transplanted into your pancreas. That can work. That has happened 35,000 times since 1966, but that's also unlikely. And in the course of hearing about this treatment out of China, I looked around. I can sign up at Eurotransplant. It's over in Leiden in the Netherlands. And approximately in 3 years, if I have the right blood tests and they screen me and I can get this treatment or this transplant, in about 3 years, I could get a new pancreas, and I think I might do it.
I was just going to do it. Why not?
Look around. If you've got type 1 diabetes or any problem with an organ, look around. And because I never even thought to do it. And now, for some reason, I thought, why not? Yeah, let's check out. Let's see if this is applicable to me. Can I go and get an organ transplant? And yes, I can. In 3 years' time, it's possible.
Okay, well, keep us posted. I mean, and to be fair, right, a lot of people may have poor eyesight but don't take the time, effort, and money to go get a surgery that would fix it, right? You're okay. Mm-hmm. To a certain extent, you can medicate. You can live your life relatively normally.
I just assumed I'd be fine, and I wouldn't want to take a pancreas away from somebody else who needs it more.
Yeah.
Right?
Okay. Well, that's great news.
Yeah.
Great news for what? Did you say nearly 10 million people around the world?
As of 2021, there were 8.4 million people around the globe with type 1 diabetes. Many, many, many more with type 2. That's a completely different disease, even though it's called diabetes. With type 1 diabetes, there are 8.4 million people. Yeah, this could be big news for them. Not yet, probably, but still scientifically, it's interesting to know.
Yeah. Well, on to some more science. This one also connected to the Netherlands and Canada. Gabe, do you have any pictures of you online that are like the kinds of pictures you would, I don't know, use to maybe get a new job or to promote yourself online? So I'm thinking sites like LinkedIn, or in German they have one called Xing with an X at the beginning, where you're out there trying to, I don't know.
Yeah, I know about these sites, but I don't have my picture on any of them.
No. Okay. A lot of people, when you look at these sites, and they're criticized for a variety of reasons, but whatever, they have a function, and a lot of people, when they put their own personal picture on there, are smiling. Mm-hmm. And that's what this research is about. It's about smiling. And what can you tell? What can most people tell from that picture that you've put up, thinking it's kind of like a neutral smile? Like, mm-hmm. Of course, hi, my name's Connor. I'm introducing myself. Here's my smile, right? That's it. No, people can tell a lot. They can learn a lot.
About the way you're smiling or that you're smiling?
Well, I hope they can see that I'm smiling. If I'm trying to smile and they don't see it, then I've failed at my smile. It's more about like all these micro expressions or aspects of your face, what they can read from that.
Okay.
And they're getting a lot more information. So what they did is two different studies, but both of them were functionally similar. The first study was trying to figure out, is there a difference between what you can read from a non-smiling picture? They had 100 photographs, and a smiling picture. And the answer was yes, like a non-smiling picture, kind of like in your passport, right?
Yeah.
Imagine the person.
You're not supposed to smile, actually.
Imagine the person, right, at immigration at the airport. From these non-smiling pictures, they really don't know much about your personality. Mm-hmm. When people don't smile and they look serious, they all kind of look the same. When you smile, though, they can start to see some differences, and those really came out in the second part of the study. What can you see from the smile? And it all comes down to a kind of smile. I've seen it referenced online. This is the first time, I think, in my life I'm saying it out loud. It's called the Duchenne smile.
The Duchenne smile. What's the Duchenne smile?
The Duchenne. It's French, Duchenne. The Duchenne smile is, these pictures where you look at yourself in the picture and you're smiling, but it looks terrible and fake.
Mm-hmm.
And then other pictures, it looks great. And you're like, that's a real smile. Mm-hmm. That real smile is probably the Duchenne. It's where, very importantly, the most important feature is that your eyes smile with your mouth. Do you know what I mean?
The reason I asked that question at the beginning, can you fake a Duchenne smile? Or is that the kind of smile that comes out genuinely?
It would obviously most naturally come out genuinely. You can probably fake it. And what this research suggests is that you should really fake it, at least for the photo that you're going to put online to market yourself with. Yeah. Because what happens is when people look at those photos, if you have the Duchenne smile, all of the warmer characteristics are associated with you. When they have a list of personality traits that they're given, they associate the good ones with you. Yeah. You're
what are those? Real quick.
Trustworthiness, conscientiousness, communion, and the more, the stronger that Duchenne, the realer your smile is, the stronger the association with that trait. They're looking for, like, this is a person I can trust. They're warm, they're friendly, I like them. If you accidentally do that thing that all of us have done, like, you know when someone's like, hey, smile for the picture, and then it takes too long, and so your real smile starts turning into this plastic smile where you look like a horrific ghoul. Like, your mouth is smiling, but your eyes are not.
Have you ever watched someone right after a genuine smile, how long it takes for them, for their face to go back to not smiling? Sometimes I do that.
Yeah,
it's pretty disgusting.
That problem
is you go from this, hey, I like looking at that, and then, oh.
And then it vanishes, snap, in an instant.
It was back to cold reality. Yeah.
It was never real. So specifically, of course, when they had these, I think it was 100 photographs of people, they had to put them through some software, and this software is called OpenFace. They had to map out all these various parts of the face. What are they doing? And when you have a Duchenne smile, there's the activation of a cheek raiser, the AU6, lip corner puller, lip parting. All of these little things go into it to show people in the end that you're actually smiling. If you don't have a Duchenne smile, now the antisocial traits come out. Okay. So I'm going to quote here, conversely, the absence or weaker presence of a Duchenne smile, particularly reduced activation of those muscles I just listed, is often linked to colder and antisocial traits like aggression and hubristic pride.
Hubristic, that's when you think way more of yourself than you should. It's
arrogance.
It's unrealistic arrogance.
You're arrogant. Yeah. So accidentally, if you didn't realize it, you could have uploaded a photograph trying to market yourself to companies around the world, and the person at the company looks and says, wow, this person is full of aggression and hubristic pride. I'm not going to take them because they didn't have the Duchenne smile. Last thing I'll say, who is...
Hold on. Let's get to the tip here. How do you fake a good Duchenne smile.
I don't have the answer to that. I think perhaps you need to think of something that makes you actually laugh.
Okay.
Maybe you need to go
so
there in your mind.
Really.
Hold on. Give me a second. Let me think of something funny I was just talking to someone about. Let me think of a funny part of a movie or something a comedian or a comedienne said. Whatever you need, do it. Or take 1,000 photographs and take the one where you actually have that Duchenne smile. Last thing I'll say is that Duchenne, I looked him up, French guy, also from the 1860s, 1862. Why that time frame? Why was he finally able to identify that kind of smile? Technology. Photography.
Cameras.
Photography was finally happening. Gabe, I'm going to slide this over. This is his attempt to start defining things. And I knew you would laugh. I knew you would laugh.
Because 16 pictures here of people. These are people going through agony.
Yeah. His primary model was a, quote, old, toothless man with a thin face.
What was he trying to figure out from this guy? This guy looks like he's going through torture.
Whose features, without being absolutely ugly, approached ordinary triviality. He was using photography and actually manipulating people's faces. Mm. Like he was pushing their eyebrows in and doing things to try to elicit.
To study their physiognomy?
Yeah. So the reason I bring that up is because it's crazy that photography had just started becoming more mainstream back at that time period, and now we're still talking about photography in a very different way. It's the same thing. Be careful what you look like and how you smile online. Make sure you've got that good Duchenne smile, and don't do the old fake Arunsky.
Yeah, only smile for real. Okay, one last thing before we go. We found a book online, a novel.
Well, actually, no, we didn't find it. You got a WhatsApp message from one of your teammates, right?
Well, I play hockey. I play roller hockey once a week. I'm on a team, and we have this WhatsApp group. And this guy writes, I've got some questions for you, Gabe. And he posts a picture of a book, a bestseller here in Germany.
You know, in whatever country you're listening to this in, how there's like a newspaper or magazine that puts its bestseller stamp on a book so that you know that tons and tons of people have bought it?
Yeah, Der Spiegel. The bestseller list in Germany is Der Spiegel. It's a bit like the New York Times in the States. On the Spiegel bestseller is a book about Connor and Gabe, two strangers, one game, one fateful night. These are two hockey players. And on the back of the book...
A German language book, right?
This is written in the German language, but we're both hockey players.
In the book.
Yeah. Or Connor and Gabe are both hockey players.
That's what's confusing. In real life, you are a hockey player. In real life, I play soccer.
Well, that's why this guy on my team said, I got questions, Gabe. Let me just read. On the back of the book, there are descriptions of Gabe and then Connor. I'll read my description, and then you can read yours. Gabe, rule number one, I stay away from straight guys. Rule number two, I also stay away from complimentary champagne at charity events. And then here for the charity game, I get picked to be on a team with NHL superstar Connor Mitchell.
Connor Mitchell is my last name.
Maybe
in this book.
Is why I got asked to join the event. How am I supposed to score goals for a good cause when I can barely stand on my feet? And how am I supposed to show that I belong in the NHL when I'm dead drunk? But the more important question, how am I supposed to stick to rule number one when Connor Mitchell is so much hotter than I thought?
Okay, so you're passing this over to me. Just again, if it's not clear at this point, there's a book that is selling well in Germany about Connor and Gabe as hockey players, and it's romance. And for Connor, in this case, ice hockey has been my life for as long as I can remember, which is not true. For as long as I can remember, I've been in my famous dad's shadow, also not true. Mm-hmm. And for as long as the lower half of my body can remember, I've been into women. As an NHL star, I can have any puck bunny I want. I don't know what they're called. Yeah. And why not? That's my prerogative. But then Gabe Ashford literally falls into my arms at my father's charity event. Oh, because you drank too much champagne in the city?
Okay. I was dead drunk, yeah.
And for the first time in years, I feel something real again. Why does touching him feel so right? And why do I suddenly want nothing more than for him, of all people, to kiss me? Puckmates, Connor and Gabe, by best-selling German author Alessia Gold.
I looked into Alessia Gold. It's a pseudonym. I'd say we talked to her.
What were
The invitation has been extended, Alessia. Talk to us on how you got the idea for a romance between Gabe and Connor.
Look,
here in Germany. Come on.
I know. If we're in the English-speaking part of the world, it would not be a very big coincidence to have Gabe and Connor's name on the title the front page of a book. In Germany, that's a little odd. That's a like I don't think you have to be too much of a conspiracy theorist to think that maybe Alessia, you had seen our podcast or heard it before. Maybe you're listening right now.
Maybe she heard the podcast and heard the chemistry that we've got going.
Oh, and then imagined us as puckmates?
Yeah. That's the name of the book, Puckmates.
Puckmates.
Gabe and Connor.
Yeah, right now available only in German, so it's not like we're, you know, marketing this for her. It's just a really weird coincidence. Alessia, we'd like to talk to you. Hopefully your agent has told you that. And all of our listeners around the world can look forward, I hope, to hearing us have a quick non-science chat with what may be one of our listeners, German author Alessia Gold.
Anything you guys got to say about the science that we spoke about today? Let us know at su@dw.com.
A lot of our listeners all around the world, whether because of the show or not, probably a lot of you are familiar with large language models. These are artificially intelligent software or programs.
Yeah. Have you ever used ChatGPT to do anything? That is what's known as an LLM.
Right. And these have changed the world in many significant ways. The ones you've probably used, whether they're from OpenAI or Google or Meta or any of the Silicon Valley companies or any other company around the world for that matter, they're probably private.
Yeah.
They're probably made by for-profit companies that have billions in resources and can do that sort of thing. And in that sense, they're very non-transparent. It's like this magic Wizard of Oz, I don't know, curtain. Yeah. And we can't look into it. We cannot see it.
Nobody on the outside knows even how it's built. What we're going to be doing now for the next couple of minutes is speaking with someone here in Germany who is helping to build a public LLM.
This matters. This is the first, not the first time, a publicly funded artificially intelligent program has been unveiled to the public, a large language model. There are surely other countries around the world doing this, but this is absolutely a good faith attempt, both in Germany and at the EU level, to create something that's transparent publicly financed, open to everyone, and that is reliable and always there? And what is it exactly? And how are they going to run it all?
Yeah.
Gabe, you and I hopped in one of Deutsche Welle's
cars.
Yeah,
we went about 40 minutes away. It's a supercomputer. It's the site of what's going to be Europe's fastest computer. And we went there to meet Stefan Kesselheim, who's behind the whole project.
Science Unscripted.
Yeah, hi, I'm Stefan. Welcome to Jülich. I'm a researcher in machine learning on supercomputers. We do all kinds of crazy AI, sometimes crazy, sometimes useful AI with the supercomputers, and trying to build cool things.
Let's start with the supercomputers. How many phones would you have to put in Jupiter, the fastest supercomputer in Europe in the future? How many of these would you have to put in there?
In order to be as fast as
Jupiter
or have as much computing potential?
I would guess you need like maybe a million, maybe only a few hundred thousand. But the problem is you will never be able to connect them fast enough. So,
okay, a million phones. Why do you need that much power? What are you doing with that supercomputer or those supercomputers over there?
We're doing research, and one example is fusion, nuclear fusion. You know that it's promised to be there in 30 years, since 30 years.
Yeah.
This is one example, but like AI is other things. There's a lot of different things going on there.
Yeah, AI, what are the plans? What are you going to do here with AI?
So we have trained a large language model that is probably not as powerful as ChatGPT, but that is definitely an alternative because it's also like it speaks many European languages.
Real quickly, because a lot of people either watching this or listening to this, I feel like people talk about large language models as if we all know exactly what they are, and I'm not sure that's true. What is it exactly? What's being built or has been built?
So when you talk to ChatGPT or any other large language model, internally it will like what you wrote as a lot of numbers, and from these numbers it will perform heavy calculations and it will always try to predict what is the next token in the sequence, what is the next what is the right symbol that comes after what was there before. And so if it speaks, it will produce one syllable after the other, and this will build your text. And if you want to train them, you have to use a lot of data, mostly from the internet, but also like other sources. And you essentially teach it to always predict reasonable next tokens, we call them.
Mm-hmm. And in this case, tokens are syllables, and it's based on probability. Probably the next syllable or the next word coming in the sequence, and hence that's my answer as a large language model.
These tokens are smaller than words, but bigger than letters. There's no good word for it, but tokens.
Token.
And what would be different about this project compared to, let's say, ChatGPT?
ChatGPT is behind the curtains of OpenAI. They don't tell you what data it was trained on. And we're this science project, and the thing that we want to do different is we want to share this information. We want to tell everybody what we did so that this is not a secret. This is not secret sauce anymore, but that like people understand what's happening there.
So I would be, if I used your project, what is it called?
OpenGPTX is the German project.
If I used GPTX, I would be able to see where the answers that I get from it come from.
This is what we would like to have. This is like, there's a lot of technology being built there. But so the thing that you need first is you need to train the model. And for that training, you need a lot of data. And nobody really knows where this data comes from. And then, like, it's more or less a black box. It learns to predict this next token and to produce the answer step by step. But you don't know what happens inside of it.
So even though you don't know what's going to come out of a large language model, like the one that's going to run on these supercomputers, still you have to be able to, and you are, I would assume, going to put filters on there so that it something that would say, if the answer is racist, misogynist, homophobic, etc., don't publish, don't send it to the end user, something like that, right? What, there's probably a term for this, filters or...
Guardrails, some people
guardrails, say. Guardrails.
Are those easy to implement?
No, they're not easy to implement. So this is like, there's two ways how you can do it. You can do it based on rules. So whenever the user says something about bombs, you just don't answer. You just say, hey.
If bombs equals no answer.
Equals no answer. But this is, of course, going to be difficult because there's a lot of alleged questions that you can ask regarding bombs. And that will like barrier users from doing very reasonable things.
So you will be censoring it then?
Is it censoring? No, it's like, I think so we're not gonna build something where you can log into a web page and talk to it. We're more in the front of the like technology developments. We're trying to build what then can be used at the later stage as a chat, but also for other tools. For example, for document processing, if you're an insurance company and you want to process the 10 million documents of your 100 million year history, you don't need an LLM that has guardrails because your input is safe. Right. It's really like a different case. In this chat case, it makes super sense to have guardrails, but there's enough cases where this is really just not necessary.
If these supercomputers, or if the future fastest European supercomputer can consume as much energy as 50,000 people living in a small city here, what is the answer to that ethics question? This technology is important, it helps a lot of people out there, and yet it's polluting.
It is.
What is the answer?
The answer is we have to understand what to do with this technology. Because computers are advancing all the time, they're getting better and better. And if we want to make sure that we in Germany, we in Europe know how this technology develops, so we are prepared and we can take part, we need to do research on this technology. And there's a price tag. And this price tag has units of euros and dollars and CO2.
Yeah, tons of CO2. Yeah.
Yes.
So without this research center here, Germany and Europe fall behind in the information race?
Yes.
Can you say that?
Yes. There's like the landscape is super wide. There's many, many research organizations and institutions in Germany and Europe. So if you cut out one, you only cut out one. But I think this overall, this academic system is super important. This is not only because their technologies develop, but also because this is where like the people who are going to build next generation technology, where they're educated.
And that was Stefan Kesselheim talking to us from the Jülich Research Center, this gigantic, expansive area full of all sorts of things happening. That's just one of them.
And what he was getting into there at the end is anybody could use this computer. If you have an idea that the Jülich supercomputer could be used for, get in touch with them. If you're in Europe and your idea is good, then they will give you time with the computer.
That'd be pretty fun. I don't have any good, well, I have lots of ideas. None of them are good at this point. What would you use Europe's fastest supercomputer for? Something that's the equivalent of 1 million phones?
Yeah.
What would you do on there? What would you ask it?
Yeah. And do you guys think that there's a point? I mean, 500 million euros went into this project. Do you guys think that this is a good idea to be spending public dollars, academic money, research money on projects like this? Let us know why at sudw.com.
DW, made for minds.